From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. David Brown returns to the show this week. He's a music journalist and historian who is the author of many fine books, and his work has appeared in Rolling Stone, as well as lots of other places. David Brown has written biographies, like his excellent book, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, The Wild Definitive Saga of the Greatest of Rock's Greatest Supergroup. And he is great at capturing the sound of a particular time and place, as in Fire and Rain, The Beatles, Simon & Garfunkel, James Taylor, CSNY, and The Lost Story of 1970. And in his excellent, most recent book, Talkin' Greenwich Village, The Heady Rise and Slow Fall of America's Bohemian Music Capital. David Brown, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks, Gary. It's great to be here again.
Before we talk about your new book, I was at the grocery store the other day, and I picked up one of those nifty Rolling Stone tribute issues that are always so great. And this one was a tribute to the King on the 90th anniversary of his birth, with a lot of excellent articles about Elvis and his musical legacy. And in that book, there was a really beautiful obituary for Lisa Marie Presley, who died in 2023, and her posthumous memoir is currently a bestseller. It's a really good book. And I was really touched by your article, and I want to thank you for writing it. I was a real admirer of her three albums, and I don't think she got enough credit as a musician.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I mean, I wanted to touch upon a lot of different aspects of her life and career when I was doing that piece. And, I thought the music stuff, those albums that she recorded, have been sort of undercovered, underappreciated, but also I thought they were just so revealing of what she was going through at different times in her life. You know, she helped write a lot of those songs. She wasn't just doing covers. You know, she was a very private person. She would promote her records or whatever when she had to, but it seemed like her songs were her way of really communicating with the world and letting them know how she felt about her father or about fame or whatever was going on. So it was really interesting to kind of delve into that process and talk to those people who worked with her and who in some cases had to really, you know, pull those lyrics out of her and say, no, she wasn't sure if she wanted to write a song that sort of alluded to her father. And they were like, no, people want to hear that. So, you know, I felt that that was worth exploring.
One of my favorite songs, I think maybe her best song, is a song called, I think it's called Excuse Me, but it's like buried on her first album as a hidden track. It's not even listed on there. And I think, well, that would have been a hit record for Sheryl Crow.
Right. I remember that one. Yes. It was, and I think she was, and I think also those records are really revealing because I think she was searching for who she was musically. You know, I mean, the first record, you know, was sort of I wouldn't call it punk at all, but it was sort of a power pop, sort of Avril Lavigne kind of sound. And then later on, the last record she made with T-Bone Burnett was much rootsier, much more Americana. And I think she felt more comfortable in that in the way. So even musically, you know, she was kind of going through a journey to find out like who she was as a person and as a singer and how she could distinguish herself.
Well, I'm sure you're really busy writing all of the books you write, but have you had a chance to read her autobiography?
And I've sort of flipped through it. I have not read it word for word, so can't comment yet.
Yeah. It's worth a
read. A lot of music books out now.
There are, I know.
Including, I'm catching up, you know, little by little.
Including Talkin' Greenwich Village, the Heady Rise and Slow Fall of America's Bohemian Music Capital. So your new book is obviously set in Greenwich Village, which is also the setting for the Oscar-nominated film A Complete Unknown, which I keep calling No Direction Home for some reason. And I'm sure a lot of the fans of the film will come running to your book to find out more. But what did you think of the film? Obviously, you've seen the film. You had time to see that.
I've seen it twice. Yeah. And I, you know, interesting experience. The movie came out just a couple of months after my book was published. So even though my book is not just about 60s folk scene and Dylan, it goes from really from the 50s to the 80s and takes in a lot of different genres and eras. But certainly, you know, there's a chunk of it devoted to that scene in the early 60s when that community arose, and Dylan was part of it. And I spoke to a bunch of people who were still with us. Some have passed since the book came out, sadly. But so I had all this trivia in my brain, so fresh in my brain as I watched the movie. And the first time, you know, I had a sort of music geek fact checker reaction to a lot of it. Like, wait a minute, I don't think Pete Seeger was in the hospital with Woody when Dylan first showed up. And I don't think Baez was there the night of the Cuban Missile Crisis watching him sing Masters of War. In fact, Dave Van Ronk was playing the Gaslight that night. And you know, did he really break up with Susie Rodolo at the Newport 65 Festival in such a dramatic way? So, you know, I had plenty of those moments. At the same time, I was impressed with Chalamet. I thought he did a terrific job, and I think they got the arc of the story. And then the second time I saw the movie, I just put all that fact-checking stuff aside. I was like, whatever, it's Hollywood. They're going to do what they do. And I thought they captured the arc of Dylan's story really well during those 4 years. I think they, you know, in a way captured the arc of the village and how commercial it became during that time as well. And so, yeah, I really enjoyed it. What did you think?
I had just about the same reaction. I mean, going in, I didn't think I would like it because I love Dylan and I know a lot about him, and therefore I don't need to see it, and I don't want to see Timothy Chalamet do an imitation of him. And I mean, I didn't like the Elvis movie at all, but I was very pleasantly, you know, shocked at how much I enjoyed it, and I also went back and saw it again. So,
that never happens. Music biopics can be real tricky, and you know, there are a lot of bad ones out there.
A lot of them. But, you know, I think one of the things they did right was like Walk the Line was good also in the same way, because they focused on one story to tell rather than try to tell every story as in, say, Ray or something like that. It didn't go on forever.
And that's an interesting approach. I mean, they tried that last year with the Bob Marley movie, which just focused on a couple of years in his life in the mid-70s. A little more of a mixed bag, I think, than A Complete Unknown. But it wasn't like, remember, speaking of Elvis, Don Johnson playing Elvis?
Yeah.
Remember the Elvis and the Beauty Queen way back in the 80s, I think?
I liked Kurt Russell as Elvis. That wasn't a bad one.
Kurt Russell was, yes, he also did it. He did a good job. Yeah. Kurt Russell did a good job. Don Johnson was an odd one.
What about Priscilla? Did you see Priscilla?
Did I see Priscilla?
That's the Sofia Coppola film.
No, I did not. I saw the Austin Butler biopic.
Right,
but
yes.
I have not seen Priscilla yet.
I think Priscilla is pretty great, but it's not about Elvis. It's about Priscilla. But it's because they weren't allowed to use any of Elvis's music in the film. Elvis is robbed of the thing that makes him special, so he just appears to be a guy that she's married to, and that's kind of interesting for a movie about Priscilla. I like that film a lot. It's very well done. But again, you know, like you say, you know what the facts are. So when you see the way they have telescoped it for storytelling, it's not quite as bad as, say, the Jolson story where, you know, almost everything is made up. But the more you know, the more you spot.
Right. And you have to just, like I said, after a while seeing, I mean, this movie in particular, you have to just keep thinking, okay, this is not a documentary. Yes, there's so many people from the village scene who are missing completely. Are seen 2 seconds in a movie in the movie who played a pivotal part in Dylan's emergence in that scene. And sort of in a way that you sort of used Pete Seeger as a sort of composite character for all of them. representing the old world and someone who nurtures him. And not sure Pete really had that big a role in nurturing Bob on that. Pete was barely in the village, actually. So there were lots of others like Dave Van Ronk, who you barely see and so forth. But, you know, again, you have to just sort of, you have to kind of just put that aside and just kind of, you know, revel in sort of what works and how, yeah, I mean, like you, I went into it with a lot of skepticism. And I mean, if you had told me when I started working on this book, which was, just 4 years ago, if you had told me back then, like, well, in 4 years from now, Timothy Chalamet, that kid, beautiful boy in all these movies I'd seen, was going to play Bob Dylan. You know, I thought you were crazy. But you know, I think he did a really good job. And you know, it's interesting. Last night, I was part of a panel discussing the movie Fact and Fiction, at the Bitter End here in the Village,
Oh, neat.
York. And Terry Thall, who was Dave Van Ronk's first wife and first manager, was there, and some other folks. And we kind of hashed all that out. And one of the people in the audience, who kind of, you know, we had a question and answer afterwards, was the guy who taught Timothy Chalamet how to play guitar for the movie.
Wow.
And he shared he worked on him with Chalamet for 4.5 years, partly because the movie was postponed because of COVID. So it didn't take 4 years to make the movie, but there were just, you know, complications. But he said, you know, Chalamet took it very seriously, you know, the singing and the guitar playing, you know, this, you know, he really bore down on the work, you know. So that was really interesting to hear.
Yeah, it was good that they all did their own singing and playing in the film, and you know, again back to the Jolson story, as opposed to have somebody lip syncing it or something like that.
Right.
And I once talked here on this show with Scotty Moore, who told me that whenever you see Elvis playing the guitar in a movie, it's Scotty Moore playing the guitar. They have a close up of the guitar playing, then it's Scotty. Otherwise, it's
Oh,
Elvis.
interesting. Okay.
But yeah, so to have him do his own guitar playing as well as his own singing, it was pretty great. And the scene when he opens his mouth for the first time and sings Song for Woody it's a great moment in the movie.
It is. It is. You're like, you really, that's the moment you think, wow, okay, this might work.
Yeah, exactly. Well, one of the people that's in your book but missing from, I mean, I think Dave Van Ronk is sort of the main character in your book. He keeps coming in and out of focus as we're going through the story. But one of the people that I was a great admirer of and knew slightly was Phil Oakes. And he's not really in the movie at all, but he was an important person in the village for sure.
He's in the movie only in the sense that at some point we hear the Joan Baez character singing There But for Fortune
Right.
at some show. But yeah, otherwise, yeah, Phil is not there at all. And, you know, that's an example of someone who really was a key person in the village. He arrived just after Dylan. He was sort of Dylan's main competition in some way. You know, Phil was as ambitious as Bob, but also, you know, much more embedded in topical songwriting than Bob was, and was more almost a journalist as a songwriter. And you know, it's interesting. You know, one of the things that I learned in my research is, or was a rem I should say reminded of in my research, was that you know, we think of Dylan getting so much grief at Newport 65 when he went electric, but it actually all started about a year before when he put out Another Side of Bob Dylan. And which, you know, as we know, was very light on the protest songs. I mean, it's basically Chimes of Freedom, which is not it's not a rabble rouser, you know, and a lot of the songs are very personal about his relationship with Susie Rodolo and stuff. And if you go back and read the reviews at the time, especially in the folk press, you know, and Sing Out and so forth, they didn't like it at all. They gave him so much grief. Like, what are you doing? What is this guy doing? This is the guy who's supposed to be leading the charge on protest songs and the civil rights movement, and he's making this record? And they all turned to Phil. You know, they're all like, well, I guess it's going to be Phil Oakes now. He's really, you know, he's leading the charge. He's now our most prominent songwriter. He's kind of leaving Dylan in the dust. So you know, it's so fascinating to see that take back then, especially an album that we all, you know, of course, take for granted now, is just such a great early record of us of his, and so great because it was different. You know, it was like he was switching gears already.
It's interesting. All of these people who are, you know, the hip people are always very resistant to change. I mean, I guess everybody is. But I remember John Lennon commenting once that everybody is freaked out when you do any kind of changing. That the people at Max's Kansas City were upset when they changed the furniture in there. And Phil Oakes, when Elektra started to promote the Doors, Phil Oakes got upset. He ran in and talked to Holtzman and said, "What happened to your ideals about folk music?"
Right, but then Phil himself moved to LA and started working with, you know, more commercial, you know, producers, and like didn't just make acoustic records. So I think they all, you know,
eventually,
you know, interesting, you know, there are interesting contradictions, you know, in the village world. Certainly that, I mean, the village was always a place starting almost 100 years ago, where, you know, sort of outsiders, kind of misfits, outcasts, outsiders came to find a like-minded community, whether you were a painter or a writer or eventually a musician. It was a place where you wanted, if you wanted to, you know, try out a new kind of song or genre, whether it was free jazz or Dylan, you know, debuting all 7 minutes of Hard Rain, you know, you could do it. But it was also a place where people came to reinvent themselves, you know, and so there was a lot of, you know, and Dylan is the first example, you know. So goodbye to Robert Zimmerman, and say hi to, you know, hi to Bob Dylan with this sort of made up past. And, you know, Ramblin' Jack Elliott was Elliot Adnapaz, the son of a Brooklyn doctor. You know, I talked to Janice Ian. She was, of course, Janice Fink. When she grew up in New Jersey and changed her name, partly because she didn't want people to know make the connection to her family. And maybe the name Fink wasn't so great anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, that stuff kind of routinely happened, that that people, you know, would sort of reinvent themselves in that way. Or in the case, and to get back to the point here of like, they're all like, we don't want to be commercial and, you know, we want to be pure. And yet, by the late 60s, people like Phil and Eric Anderson, David Blue, and many others had moved to Los Angeles to make records and pursue a career out there. So, you know, there was a lot of struggle, I think, in that section, in that neighborhood, I should say, about purity versus authenticity and all of that.
We're talking with David Brown. His new book is called Talk in Greenwich Village, The Heady Rise and Slow Fall of America's Bohemian Music Capital. How did you write this book, David? I mean, you really had to corral a lot of personalities, and you come back and forth, which you you know, did also with in Fire and Rain, which I love, but that's just a 1 year book, and this book is a 40-year book.
it was the most challenging book I've ever done, and thank you for the comparison to Fire and Rain, because there actually was a similarity to that, in that, yes, I knew the arc of the story I wanted to tell, especially having, you know, moved to New York City to start my college career in the late 70s, and observing that period in the village music scene from the late 70s into the 80s, and seeing a kind of a new generation rise up, and knowing some of the history. So this idea is always kind of, I think it's been in my head for a while to do it. And when I finally decided, okay, I want to do it now, 4 years ago. I put together this kind of a living document timeline, where I would just throw in any kind of event that was interesting from my research, from interviews I've done, from flipping through the Village Voice, you know, from the 50s. And then, you know, and just sort of let the chips fall where they may. And certainly, I use little index cards which would each have a particular event. You know, Gertie's Folk City opens, or Gertie's Folk City closes, or Dylan arrives in New York City, or you know, National Lampoon's Lemmings opens. That was a big deal in the village in 1973. Christopher Guest, John Belushi, all those folks, pre-Saturday Night Live. So, and I would just like spread the cards all on the floor, you know, and put them, try to figure out an order to them. And certainly one of the things I knew right away was that I wanted to humanize the story. I didn't want it to just be a list of, you know, which club opened and which club closed and who played this club and who played that club. I wanted to kind of humanize the story as much as I could and tell it through, show the rise and fall, as I say, through certain characters, stories who people who are intertwined. And Dave Van Ronk was someone I knew was going to be in this book from the beginning. You know, he was there in the late 50s when it was starting to come together. He lived in the village the entire time until his death in 2002. He never left. He was sort of, they called him the mayor of McDougal Street. He became this sort of he was a mentor even in the 60s when he was fairly young to people like Dylan. He was a mentor later to some of the later generation of the, you know, Steve Forbert, Suzanne Vega kind of world. So I knew that I wanted him in there. And then the more I did my research, I found out, oh, he gave guitar lessons to the guys in the Blues Project. And he was a big mentor to Maggie and Terry Roach, who became the Roach Sisters, who were, you know, kind of one of the leading lights of the later scene. So it just kind of fell together in that way. I thought, well, oh, maybe he can be part of the glue that holds this book together. And you see the scene through his own experiences with it.
It's kind of a sad book because Greenwich Village is over. I mean, it really does feel over because, you know, it's the way things have changed in the city for one, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's
like a 500 year history.
It is a sad book in certain ways. I mean, you know, there is still music being played. As I mentioned, the Bitter End is still up and running. The Cafe Wa, where Dylan there, just stopped, is still up and running. The Village Vanguard, which will be, you know, which is like approaching its 90th anniversary, which is, you know, crazy to think about, is still there. So, you know, there are places you can still go. There's a great jazz club called Smalls that opened in the 90s that has great jam sessions. So, but it's not what it was, you know, for sure. And I think, I mean, I see this book as not just a story about the Village music scene. I mean, I think it really is about the rise and fall in some ways of bohemian culture in America. The Village is a metaphor for that, the way that so many of these clubs, these venues that really fostered so much of this, so many different types of music and welcomed all these, you know, like I said, all these kind of outsiders and rebels, you know, one by one, these clubs are replaced. Are closed down, and they don't reopen. They reopen as a drugstore, a chain drugstore, or a bank.
Yeah, we need another Dwayne Reed.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it's just blanded out. You know, there are parts of that neighborhood now where you walk down, and you know, there's lots of really high-end clothing stores now, high-end restaurants, and that's, you know, that's fine, but it's completely changed so much of the character of the neighborhood. You barely know. There were dozens of venues just a couple of decades ago.
Yeah, on the other side where St. Mark's Place is, you know, St. Mark's Place, none of the places that were there that I love to go on St. Mark's Place are there. It's all restaurants now, and even Gem Spa's gone forever, which is like sad.
Yeah, a lot of my favorite used record stores were on St. Mark's Place, and I think they are all gone. Unfortunately, but it's worth pointing out though, just for listeners that, cause people ask me this sometime, my book is about the West Village. So people say, right, yes. Well, where's CBGB's? Well, you know, I mention it, but my focus of my book is what is traditionally known as Greenwich Village, which if you're a New Yorker, it's Broadway and west to the Hudson. So I don't go east into CBGB's and that stuff. Stories that have been told many times and told really well, but I felt like the West Village, from 14th to Canal Street as north south, that's a story that hadn't really been told yet. I think it's another reason I wanted to do this book is that, you know, no one had written this narrative history yet, it's a book I always wanted to read. I think that's one of the reasons I do some of my books. You know,
you want
to
read them, so you have
no one's
read
a book about 1970. Like, that was a fascinating year. Okay, I'll do that. And this was an example. I thought, you know, especially since I had all that history in my head and, you know, in the 80s, I worked for the Daily News as a reporter, one of my first jobs. And so I was going to a lot of those clubs to cover them, but also seeing them close one by one, witnessing it sort of myself. And then I really accelerated in the 90s. So, yeah, it just it was kind of a natural project for me.
The first time I saw Bob Dylan in concert was in 1974, and he was touring with the band, that big tour. And,
oh, wow.
And I loved it.
Which show did you see?
I saw the Valentine's Day show in the afternoon at the Forum in Los Angeles.
It was an afternoon show?
Yeah, there were two shows that day. And, in fact, that was the one they used on the record Before the Flood. The show that I went to. That same night, I saw Phil Oakes and Mimi Farina on a double bill at another theater.
Oh, wow.
But
that's amazing. That's quite a 1-2 punch for one day.
Yeah, it's crazy. I know. I was standing out in front of the theater waiting for the Phil Oakes show, and Oakes got out of his cab. He arrived in a taxi, and he had a cast on his arm. And I said hello, and I said, "How are you going to play with that on your arm?" And then he just mimed holding a pick and moving his arm up and down. Like that, you know. But
that's what he did for the show.
Yeah, he played with a pick in his claw that he was holding.
Wow,
he was a funny guy. But when I saw Dylan in '74, I thought, "Oh, you know, I've missed the golden age of Dylan," not realizing that I was watching the golden age. And I wonder, when you got to New York in 1978, did you think, oh, I've missed this great period, and here I am kind of at the close, even though it was still had decades to go?
I felt that way growing up in my life. I mean, that's why I wrote my book Fire and Rain in 1970, because, you know, I have two older sisters. One was 10 years older than me, one was 13 years older. And, you know, I sort of, you know, in the early 70s, I would, you know, I would hear, well, not necessarily directly from them, but the culture was telling me, we're in the 70s now. You just missed the golden era of all time in the 60s, whether it's the Beatles, Woodstock, you name it. You missed all that. And welcome to, you know, Grand Funk Railroad and gas shortages. You know? So I always had that in my mind. And certainly when I moved to the Village to start my receiving my journalism degree at NYU, you know, part of the reason I went is because they had a good journalism program, but also was the idea of living in the Village in a dorm. And there was, even though I was well aware that I was not going to see Dylan on the street, and Phil Oakes had just died 2 years before, you know, so many of the legends were just not around anymore. But the first night that I was there, I moved into my dorm and I had three roommates. We decided to go out for a walk. You know, I had been in the Village a little bit, record shopping when I was in my high school years, but none of them had been in New York City before. So we all just, you know, went wandering around and eventually found ourselves on Bleecker Street. And I remember we walked past. It was a Sunday night, which was a slow night, but still, you know, the Bitter End was up and running, and we heard music coming out of there. The Village Gate, which was that started in the late 50s and had so many great jazz and R&B people, that was still up and running. It was a new club called Kenny's Castaways that had just opened that would eventually be like a gathering spot for the next generation of folks. We walked by that. There was the Bottom Line, which at that point was just a couple of years old and was already this sort of landmark. So even then I was like, oh, okay, there's still something happening here. It's you know, the city was in a funk after its, you know, Gerald Ford, you know,
dropped it,
shut down moment, and there was a kind of pall over the city and the Village, but you still had the sense of that there was some there was history, not only history there, but maybe that there was still activity. There was still maybe a future to it, that it still was a place where people like me could go and immerse myself in this sort of, you know, city within a city, like the Village is. I mean, it really feels unlike any other part of the city to this day.
Well, you know, you have eclectic taste in music, obviously, and your book is about not just folk music, but rock music and jazz and so on. You can't love it all. Is it difficult to write about music if you don't personally love that particular music that you're writing about?
That's a good question. No, actually, I mean, I've done that a lot throughout my career. You know, I've always considered myself a bit of a generalist when it comes to music writing, and then I don't always just write about one genre. You know, and I think that comes from growing up with, you know, my dad was a huge big band fan, and Glenn Miller and Claude Thornhill were his guys. My mom was like a Sinatra, Billie Holiday person. My older sisters were into, like, you know, the classic rock of the 60s. And early 70s, and my dad loved the Carpenters too. So I mean, I grew up hearing so much music, of different types of music around. And some of it I loved, and some of it I just sort of tolerated, as you do when you're a little kid hearing Frank Sinatra. But you know, I certainly, it was all inserted into my brain, and so I think I've sort of carried that with me. And I think, you know, in the case of I don't know, I'm trying to think, in this book, I mean, I knew what free jazz was, and I'd heard, you know, some of that, and I had some of those Coltrane records, but this a book allowed me to go a little deeper into that and listen to some more Ornette Coleman and do the history of the five spot, which I didn't know that much about. And so even though, do I throw on an Ornette Coleman record every day?
No.
But, you know, it's great. It's really cool stuff. And learning about it and appreciating it and seeing the context that it was in was the important part. I thought, oh, this is another example of, you know, you go into your kind of reporter journalist side, and it's like, oh, yeah, this is another example of a type of music that might not have thrived anywhere except in the village at that time, when you had all these little venues and people, you know, club owners willing to give something a shot, musicians willing to kind of like try something that hadn't done before in a location like the village. You weren't in Midtown, you weren't in some swanky club, you were in some basement or some, you know, maybe a street level place that was kind of tucked away, and you could just give something a shot. You know, you could, David Amram telling me when he would, you know, discovered Cafe Bohemia, which was in a basement in the West Village, and he'd go see Mingus there and sit in with him, and you never knew what you were going to get hit with musically or personally. Mingus was a physical guy, you know, he could jab you in the his elbow in your ribs and say, stop playing, like he did to Amram. But you know, those kind of, I found it an educational experience on so many levels. So, you know, I enjoyed writing about stuff I didn't necessarily listen to daily.
Well, we're talking with David Brown, and you've been associated with Rolling Stone magazine. And it's funny that you mentioned the Carpenters. Like, there was a period long before you got there, but that Rolling Stone was kind of setting not only the taste of mainstream rock, but also setting what, you know, being kind of snobby about certain things. Like, you know, Rolling Stone famously didn't like Led Zeppelin, or they didn't give the Carpenters the time of day, and didn't consider them, you know, worthy because they were pleasant, or I don't know what that was that they didn't like about them.
Right. They did eventually put them on the cover, but it was like, it was 1975, which was kind of like just as the Carpenters had peaked, I'm glad they did. They were a little late to the game on that, but and it's funny, I just saw the new Led Zeppelin movie, Becoming Led Zeppelin, yesterday. Mm. And there's a whole thing about that Rolling Stone review and how, you know, and they all talk about it now in interviews. They all still remember it. You know, they were so happy with that first album, and the record company was thrilled, and they put it out there, and there's this Rolling Stone review that, you know, calls Robert Plant's vocals prissy, and slams Page's production and all this stuff. And
it was before the era of,
I was nine. So, yeah. But
it was before the era of stars. But if they had, it would have been like two stars or something.
Something like that. It probably would have been. They didn't have stars until the 80s, I think. So I mean, you know, but that said, I mean, yes, the magazine certainly early on maybe had a bit more of a rock and sort of classic R&B and soul. You know, there's a lot of coverage of you know, Ike and Tina Turner and so many others in the early days. But yeah, you know, it's evolved.
It has. But and I think it's, of course, less influential now because it's not the only paper. It's not a paper anymore, but it's not the only paper out there like it was when it
ran. I don't know. I mean, I would say it's as influential as it was. I mean, we do political reporting has always been part of Rolling Stone.
Absolutely. You
know? And we have a great team now who are really doing a fantastic job of covering, you know, the daily craziness at the moment. But also, as far as the music coverage, I mean, I grew up at a time, I remember, you know, graduating college and you know, in the years afterwards and being a young freelancer. And I'd go into Barnes & Noble or a newsstand, you know, in the city. And you know, I think, oh, I wonder who I could try to pitch stories to. And, you know, there would be an entire section of music magazines.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, Cream and Musician and, you know, I could just go down the list. The Record, which was a Rolling Stone music magazine for a while.
Yeah.
I would talk to them. And they're all kind of gone now. You know, certainly in print, maybe some of them survive in some form online. But, you know, you still have Pitchfork. That's been sort of swallowed up by, you know.
Spin was another one, remember?
Spin is still around and it's a website.
Yeah.
And that's good. But, you know, it's just like The Village, which once had tons of clubs. There aren't a slew of music magazines anymore. So I think, you know, I think people turn to us. Maybe, I mean, I'm biased. I shouldn't even say this, but I mean, turn to us as much as they did because there's just not, you know, there aren't that many other.
How often is Rolling Stone published now? Twice.
The print version is monthly.
Monthly.
It used to be every 2 weeks.
Right.
And then it switched to a monthly in 2018 under our new owners. But, you know, the website, I mean, we post
every day, right?
Yeah, tons of stuff every day on the website. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, I still read it and love it, but it used to be, you know, like it would guide me in a way, I think is what I was trying to get to before talking about Led Zeppelin and the Carpenters. Like, I better not listen to that because Rolling Stone says it's no good.
Well, you know, the internet has really changed all that. I mean, I was the same way growing up. I mean, there are records that I would think about buying, and I'd read a bad review in Rolling Stone or, you know, or Cream or Stereo Review had a great record review. And if I read something like a bad review, I would hesitate. I go, maybe I shouldn't buy that.
Yeah.
But now, you know, if you have a streaming service, that record is up and out there.
People buy it no matter what people think.
You can make your own. You can judge for yourself. And I think, you know, that's had probably an impact on the influence of criticism. I'd like to think that even if someone, you know, listens to the new album by, you know, whatever, Beyonce, the day it's out, maybe they'll go back and say, oh, well, I like this, but I wonder what people are saying about it. And then read reviews. I do that with movies a lot. I'll go see a movie without reading reviews. And then I'll go back and see what people have said about it now that I know what it is, you know?
Yes.
And I hope people do that with music now.
I think they do. I mean, one of the things that's changed since you and I were young was, you know, if I wanted to hear a record, I had to have that record in my hand and play it. There wasn't any other, you might hear a song on the radio, but there was no other way of hearing a record other than having the record and playing it. Whereas you don't have to do that now to hear.
And if you didn't hear a record on the radio, especially even FM, which would be more progressive and more, you know, open-minded in its playlist, even if you would see some record, in the store, you know, but not hear a single thing from it on even FM radio, you would think, huh, even they're not playing, you know, say one of the later Sly Stone records, for example, you know, you know, these records like Heard You Missed Me, Now I'm Back, or, you know, some of those later records would come out and you wouldn't hear a single song from on FM radio. And that would also be a sign you'd think,
do I want to spend $3.99?
Maybe I shouldn't buy that one.
Yeah, I mean, certain artists, like Judy Sill, you know, she was completely lost. Nobody played her on the radio. And if you didn't have that record, then you wouldn't know her. Now people know her, but they didn't know her in 1970 or 73 or whenever when her two albums came out. I happened to get them for 66 cents.
That's the good thing about and for Judy Sill fans, we did a great piece on her by my colleague Andy Martoscio, Angie Martoscio, a couple of years ago, where she kind of dug into her whole story. And I think that's the good thing about streaming services, that you can, you know, like, you know, back in the day, you know, we would The Hunt was part of the fun. I mean, you mentioned Phil Oakes.
Yeah.
You know, I remember, you know, being in college in the Village, and you know, I would spend probably an obscene number of hours in daylight hours on weekends in used record stores, flipping through those bins. And I would always be in search of his, you know, among others, his records, like Rehearsals for Retirement.
A great record.
Yeah, a fantastic record from 1969 that, you know, is one of his more sort of rocking sort of records, and also chronicles his incoming depression after the 68 Democratic
convention. It has his own gravestone on the cover, for instance.
Gravestone on the cover, yes. And that record was like extinct. You know, you there were no streaming services, there was no internet. You had to like keep going to record stores and going to the O section of the used bins. And eventually I found one, you know, but it felt like it took a couple of years, you know, and that's the internet. I will say, you know, streaming services is good. If you want to hear Judy Sill or that Phil Oakes record, you don't have to do that anymore. It's all there for you. And, you know, The Hunt was part of the fun for me. But, you know, there's also advantages to just having stuff so easily accessible.
Well, in your new book, David Brown, talking Greenwich Village, the heady rise and slow fall of America's bohemian music capital. You have little biographies of lots of great artists, and you spend some time with the Roaches, and I love them. They were great, and it was really interesting. That's one of their one of those Hunt for records. I happen to have bought Seductive Reasoning when it came out. I found a promo copy for $1.98 in the bin.
Nice.
And And I loved that record, especially Malachy's. What a great song that is. So I was into them. I'd seen, and you mentioned this, I had seen their picture, their little picture on the gatefold sleeve of There Goes Rhyme and Simon on the inside. I said, who are those cute girls? And that's what led me to seek them out. I loved that you visited them and really told their whole story really well in the book.
Yeah, I thought they were – thanks. And like Van Ronk, I thought you could really see the evolution of the Village through them. You know, he kind of – they met him. Maggie and Terry, who were just teenagers, came into the Village. They meet Van Ronk. He kind of introduces them to the scene at the time, which is the very, very end of the 60s. And, you know, they take a songwriting class with Paul Simon. And you know, they're an early example of, you know, the Village went through kind of a funk in the early to mid 70s. You know, a lot of the clubs were starting to close, and the Dylans of the world, well, Dylan came back briefly and he was in and out, and all the Phil Oakses were gone and more or less, and you know, there were harder drugs on the streets. It was a tougher time. And you know, so the Roaches have this kind of false start where Maggie and Terry, thanks in part to Paul Simon, get a record deal. But, you know, one thing about the Village musicians that I think unites so many of them in many genres is there's a certain stubborn, uncompromising, we are what we are, take us or leave us attitude to a lot of them. Van Ronk was a great example of that. They wanted to sell records. They were not averse to that, but they kind of always wanted to do it on their terms. And I think the Roaches were an example of that. They went along with Paul Simon. They used some, you know, as a big producers on their records. But, you know, they weren't the most commercial act. And the record comes out, the one you bought, Seductive Reasoning, and the record company's like, okay, can you, for the album cover, we're going to, like, you know, put you in some nice upscale, you know, clothing. And, you know, they try to remake them from this sort of funkier hippie chick, you know, kind of vibe that they had. And I use that term "chick" in an old school way. that's an old term that I'm using, by the way. And they rebelled. They were just like, "No, that's not us. We can't do this." And the record comes out, and they just like leave for Louisiana. for a trip for, 6 months and completely leave the record company and their manager and Paul Simon completely in the lurch. And, eventually regroup with their younger sister, Suzzy, become the Roaches, and become the talk of the town in the late 70s. And so you see, right at a time when this village is coming alive again. So I think their journey, again, as with Van Ronk's, really captures the changes in the village in the 70s.
David Brown, who did you talk to when you were putting this book together? Who did you interview?
Oh, it was a huge list. I mean, I think it ended up being close to 150. So, I mean, I basically reached out to anybody and everybody who was still with us from as far back as I could up to more recent things. So, it was, everybody from, Sonny Rollins, who played the Village Vanguard in the 50s, 1957, when it switched to an all jazz format, up through, many people from the folk scene in the 60s who are still with us, from, members of the Blues Project who were kind of in that scene, and John Sebastian and Happy Traum, who just unfortunately we lost last summer, Carolyn Hester, all the way through, Eric Anderson, Tom Paxton, many of those legends. And then, into the 70s, like I said, the Roach Sisters, Loudon Wainwright III, Suzanne Vega, Steve Forbert, Sean Colvin, who also came from that scene. I got a great interview with Christopher Guest talking about that National Lampoon Lemmings show which was at the Village Gate in 1973. He had some amazing stories about that. That was the happening thing, and the only thing happening in the village in 1973. It was a wider range of the people who ran the later edition of Gertie's Folk City. So it was a track down Dolores Dixon, who was a young black singer in the early 60s, who, as part of a group called the New World Singers, sang Blowing in the Wind before Peter, Paul, and Mary. And nobody remembers that or remembers her. And so she's still with us. Had a close relationship with Dylan that she talked about. And so, Paul Stuckey, for Peter, Paul, and Mary, it was a cavalcade of stars, I'd say.
That must have been a fun journey. Were they all open to talking to you about their village memories?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think there were probably a couple of big stars who emerged from that who I wasn't able to get, but just because they're big
stars. Like Bob Dylan?
Like Bob, I did reach out to Bob Dylan. I absolutely put in that request, knowing that he normally does not do such things. And he wrote about a lot of that in Chronicles. So,
yeah.
But his team was very nice, and they were like, we're happy to put in the request. And, that's all you can do.
Have you ever interviewed Bob Dylan?
I have not. I hate to say it.
No, that's all right.
I've never gotten that assignment.
Since you wrote your Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young book, David Crosby has passed away. And were you sort of surprised that they let their 50th anniversary go by without getting back together and doing something?
Yes and no. That was a very fraught time because, 2019 is when that book came out, and that was their 50th. And that was that moment when there had been a huge schism in the band, where Crosby and Nash had the big falling out, and they were not in touch at that point. I mean, I heard there were some, there were people who were floating it in the business world of trying to do that. But, Crosby had given that interview a couple of years before, where he had, taken a shot at Daryl Hannah, who was Neil's new flame and potential wife, and Neil not happy about that. And so things were more fraught than ever, which is saying a lot in the history of that band in 2019. So it kind of didn't surprise me that nothing quite happened.
Did Crosby, Nash ever patch it up? Do you know?
Supposedly, right before he died, Crosby called Nash and left him a message. And it was the first time they had communicated in something like at least five, 16, I think 2015, 2016 was the last time they had spoken, and this was 2023. So 7-ish years, 6-7-ish years, which is crazy. I mean, there's guys who had been basically in daily touch for 40 years. So he supposedly called Nash, left a message, and Nash didn't call back right away, you know, and I think Crosby died like right after, which is really kind of tragic. You know, it's too bad those guys didn't catch it up.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a wonderful book, and it really spans so many years and so much great music and so many personalities we haven't talked about, like Fred Neil and John Sebastian, the New York Dolls. It's a wonderful book, and I appreciate you coming and talking to us about it, David Brown. The book is called Talking Greenwich Village, The Heady Rise and Slow Fall of America's Bohemian Music Capital, and the author, the brilliant David Brown. Thanks so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks, Gary, and thanks for sharing your memories, too, of Phil and Bob on the same night and many more.
Joining me now is Lissa Warren. She is the president and founder of Lissa Warren PR, a company that specializes in book and author publicity. She teaches at Emerson College in Boston, and she's very active on X. Lissa at underscore Warren. Did I get it right?
Lissa underscore Warren.
Yeah. And here she is. Lissa, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Hello, Gary.
Good to talk to you. You have a new book for us?
I do. It's called From the Shadow of the Blues, My Story of Music, Addiction, and Redemption. And it's by John Lee Hooker, Jr. He is the son of blues legend John Lee Hooker, who is best known for hit songs like Boogie Chillin', I'm in the Mood, and Boom Boom. Now, Junior, as he's known, was born in Detroit, and he was exposed to the music world at a very early age. He was singing as the featured attraction in his father's shows as a teenager. In 1972, he and his dad performed live and recorded an album at Soledad Prison. And Junior seemed to kind of have a golden ticket to a successful music career. But trouble brewed. It's never as straightforward or easy as it sounds like it might be. His dad's marriage was in trouble, and the family was ripped apart, and John Lee Hooker Jr. turned to drugs and alcohol. The drug addiction and a series of related crimes, including as a con player, landed Jr. in and out of jails and prisons, including the infamous San Quentin, for 3 decades. He was shot, he was stabbed, he was convicted multiple times, and he was at his lowest point doing time at a jail in Santa Rita. But he emerged clean and sober and began a successful career as a blues singer. He even earned 2 Grammy nominations, and he opened for the Rolling Stones. Now, speaking of the Rolling Stones, this book was blurbed by none other than Keith Richards.
Wow.
But also musical greats like Taj Mahal, who, if you were watching the Grammys the other night, you just saw, Charlie Musselwhite, Larry DiBattiste, like big deal people blurbed this wonderful book. It really is a phenomenal story. He turned out just fine. I don't want to give away the ending too much, but it ends up not being a downer of a book at all. I recommend it very highly. It is just available this week. It just came out. So get your hot little hands on it, because it's a keeper. It's a really good one.
From the Shadow of the Blues, My Story of Music, Addiction, and Redemption by John Lee Hooker Jr. What, does he talk about his relationship with his father?
He does. He's very candid about it. They actually had a wonderful relationship, but, you know, his father cheated on his mother and the family did break apart. And so that was incredibly hard on Jr. But his dad showed him this whole wonderful world of music. The thing is, blues music, it's a pretty rough crowd in some ways, you know. I mean, you think rock stars and, you know, heavy metal musicians, and, you know, that they're the kind of dangerous ones, and they have dark experiences. Well, yeah, maybe that's sometimes true, but there's a lot of that in the world of the blues as well. And that was not an environment that was conducive to Jr. doing well. And he realized that and he got out of that. And now he performs gospel music and he preaches at churches and prisons across the U.S. and Germany, which is where he lives. He married a German woman and he is living there now. So he devotes himself to his faith fully these days and, you know, feels very strongly that that's what saved him from all of the troubling paths that he was on, which were numerous.
Wow. So how long was he incarcerated?
All told, he was in and out of prison for about 30 years. And wow. One of the stories in the book that I like the most is the book kind of opens with him playing at Soledad prison with his father. And then later on, he goes to jail at Soledad. And then later on, he goes and preaches at Soledad. So you really see him come full circle. I mean, it just makes a heck of a narrative arc for the book, but it also is a heck of a story. So he did a lot of time. He was a rough character, but you get the impression he's a very good-hearted man. He just fell into, you know, a lot of bad people and a lot of bad things. He owns up to it in the book. He's not shying away from all of the lousy things that he did and the people he hurt along the way.
And does he play guitar?
He does play all kinds of instruments from what I understand, but I think of him primarily as a singer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I met John Lee Hooker once. I was working at a record store and, he came in, he was going to be playing in town, and he came in to see if his records were there, which they were. And I asked him to sign a copy of his album for me, and he took it, and I gave him a Sharpie, and he like studied it, and he was like writing. I was thinking, what is he really writing a lot? Is he writing me like a little, he hardly knows, he has just met me, what's he going to say? And when he hands it back to me, it said, John.
Oh my
yeah,
God.
And it was spelled J-O-N, which is not how he spells his name.
No, he spells it with an H.
Yeah, it just said John.
That's
I think literacy was one of his things.
That's very odd.
But it was a thrill to meet him. Yeah, I'm a great admirer.
Explain it. But yeah, I mean, he was a legend. He is a legend.
Yeah, yeah.
He's deceased now, but his music lives on.
Yeah, he's been
and his music
gone for
lives
25
on and
years.
His son too, certainly.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm interested in reading that book, and maybe we'll get a chance to talk to him. Is he doing a book tour?
Yeah, he is from Germany via Zoom.
Via Zoom, works. My Zoom works perfectly.
Which works beautifully, apparently.
All right. Well, thank you, Lissa Warren, for telling us about this book and the title one more time.
From the Shadow of the Blues, My Story of Music, Addiction, and Redemption.
Thanks so much, Lissa. Let's talk again soon. That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.